It's Wednesday, May 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, an international group meets to discuss Syria and Libya.
There are very important parliamentary elections in Hong Kong coming up in September, and also the so-called election of Hong Kong's chief executive in March next year.
China sends a high-ranking official to Hong Kong. The Zika virus and the debate on whether to hold the Rio Olympics. And we set our sights on one athlete aiming for gold. It's all on today's International Edition. Members of the 17-nation International Syria Support Group are meeting in Vienna to find ways to bolster the cessation of hostilities and provide immediate humanitarian access to besieged communities. A senior U.S. official told reporters on Tuesday the target of August 1st has been set to have a framework in place for a political transition in Syria that remains an objective. On Monday, a multilateral group of 20 countries and four international organizations considered demands from Libya's new unity government for exemptions from a UN arms embargo so it can take steps to end that country's five-year period of chaos, including the growing threat posed by Islamic State. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and his Italian counterpart co-chaired the Vienna talks that included the government of National Accord's Prime Minister Fayez al-Sarraz.
It is imperative to put the international community's full weight behind the government of National Accord, and the GNA is the only entity that can unify the country and address the economic crisis and humanitarian suffering. The international community will support the Presidency Council as it seeks exemption from the UN arms embargo to acquire those weapons and bullets needed to fight Daesh and other terrorist groups. The arms embargo does allow for the government of National Accord to request weapons if it needs them specifically to secure the country and to combat Daesh. We will measure whatever requests there are for their legitimate arms requests with our call to all states to improve the enforcement of the arms embargo itself in order to prevent arms transfers from taking place to people outside of the GNA's authority. So it's a delicate balance.
The government of National Accord, which only arrived in the country March 30th, has the backing of Libya's Western administration, but not yet that of the internationally recognized Eastern government. VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins is traveling with Secretary Kerry and tells International Edition host Susan Yaki more regarding Syria from Tuesday's meeting.
In a joint news conference with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and UN Special Envoy Stepan de Mistura, Kerry spelled out the measures the ISSG had agreed on to help reduce violence and spur the delivery of humanitarian aid in Syria. He said the group agreed that if a party to the ceasefire persistently violated the truce, then that party could be excluded from the agreement. He also said that as of June 1st, the World Food Program would make arrangements to accelerate airdrops and regular air flights into designated besieged areas if relief workers were denied humanitarian access. Also, the group urged rebels to disassociate themselves from Islamic State and al-Nusra Front terrorists. Lavrov said there had been a number of cases in which terrorist groups had made alliances with these groups that were part of the ceasefire. Now, Kerry appeared slightly irritated by a question on whether the U.S. was losing the ability to exert pressure on President Bashar al-Assad's regime to fully comply with agreements such as the adherence to the ceasefire, supporting talks on a political transition, and allowing unrestricted access to besieged areas for humanitarian aid. His response was, the United States of America always has leverage.
Was there optimism about Syria's future?
Well, the best way that I would describe it is that the process was mixed. Kerry Lavrov and de Mistura noted the ceasefire violations, the problems with getting in humanitarian access in some areas, and also the challenges with the political talks. But they all seemed resigned to forge ahead to try to implement the agreements that had been put in place.
So what is next on the support group's agenda?
It's unclear at this point when the group will meet again. More than likely, the next meeting will be in Geneva, and that would involve the UN-facilitated proximity talks between the Syrian regime and the opposition. UN envoy Dina Stewart declined to set a date. He said there were several factors, such as the upcoming Ramadan holiday. He also said he wanted to see if the cessation of hostilities improved, as well as the efforts to get humanitarian aid delivered.
VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins in Vienna. We turn now to what's trending online, and to do that, we have our social media correspondent, G. Abby Lee, here in the studio. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim.
What are we talking about today?
We are talking about someone quite close to where we are. A congressional candidate in Virginia accidentally revealed his habit of watching adult films by sharing a screen grab on Facebook. DCS, the website about Washington, D.C., captured it the best in a tweet that reads like this. Porn-watching Virginia politician fails to close tabs, claims to be researching computer viruses.
Oh, my. Well, so who is this person and how did it unfold?
I've never heard of him before, but his name is Mike Webb and he's running for Congress in Virginia's 8th District. He's running as an independent after losing the Republican primary and posted an attack against his opponent on Facebook Monday afternoon. And boy, did it backfire. His post included a screenshot from a web browser where he forgot to close all the tabs. Two of the tabs had questionable titles, if you will.
Well, Mike Webb wishes he wasn't on the web. What's the reaction like on social media?
You know, many people seem to be, quote-unquote, more concerned about something else other than the search results. Tampa, Florida-based anchor Jameson Euler tweeted, Mike Webb should be ashamed and embarrassed. He uses Yahoo for his search engine. Another Twitter user also wrote, Mike Webb uses Yahoo as a search engine. Embarrassing, vote him out. And yes, hashtag Mike Webb is a trending hashtag. Other people expressed dismay for how long the story is staying on the web. A user named Alex Chiba tweeted, for the love of God, does Mike Webb have friends on... have no friends on the internet. Hashtag Mike Webb, it's still up. No kidding, more than 32,000 people are talking about him on Facebook alone.
Wow, what a harsh audience. Well, maybe he thinks no publicity is bad publicity.
Perhaps.
What else is trending?
American billionaire George Soros lowered his stock holdings in the U.S. by 37% and spent that money in buying gold. He was once quoted as saying gold is the best investment in a recession. So not great news for the U.S. economy. Many media outlets are tweeting about the story first reported by Bloomberg. Jim?
And maybe it had some impact. The stock market's down a little bit in the United States today.
I see.
Well, thanks for the wrap-up, G. You can tweet your questions and comments to at VOA underscore IE. And if you like, you may tag myself and G on those tweets. We are at VOA Stevenson and at G Abby Lee. Here are some of the top stories that are trending now in Asia. U.S. eases some Myanmar sanctions. Pakistan too early to declare Afghan Taliban irreconcilable. Search continues for missing in Indonesia flash flood. Chinese LGBT fear abuse, UN finds. And China's cultural revolution caused severe harm, according to state media. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more on our website, voanews.com, and you can also find them on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. The most senior Chinese official to visit Hong Kong in 4 years Tuesday promised to listen to all sectors of society's suggestions and demands. Zhang Jiejiang chairs China's legislature and is the first top official from Beijing since the pro-democracy Occupy protests of 2014. Thousands of police have been deployed, roads have been blocked, and even paving stones glued down to prevent demonstrators from using them in a protest. During a three-day visit, Zhang is to attend an economic conference, meet with legislators, including a handful of pro-democracy lawmakers, and dine with Chief Executive Leung Chun-ying, who will post his post, rather, will be up for election in 2017. Willie Lam is an adjunct professor at the Center for Chinese Studies at Chinese University in Hong Kong, and he tells VOA's Victor Beatty the growing calls for independence from Beijing are tied to what he calls China's increasing resistance to calls for political reform.
As a result of Beijing's intransigent policy towards Hong Kong and efforts by Beijing to squeeze the pace of democratic development in Hong Kong, there has been a rise of nativist indigenous sentiments among the younger generation.
This is a rare visit, the first, I believe, according to one report, in 4 years by a senior Chinese official. Why is this trip being made now?
There are very important parliamentary elections in Hong Kong coming up in September, and also the so-called election of Hong Kong's chief executive in March next year. So one major mission of Mr. Zhang is to size up the potential candidates for the next chief executive, and also to decide whether the incumbent chief executive, Mr. Xi Wai Leung, who is intensely unpopular in Hong Kong, should be given a second term.
This is the first visit by a top Chinese official since the 2014 so-called Occupy Democracy protests. Is independence a big topic of discussion in Hong Kong today?
Most Hong Kong people realize that, practically speaking, there is no possibility for Hong Kong to become independent. So at this stage, the question of holding a referendum to decide Hong Kong's future has occupied the attention of mostly young people, college students, as well as perhaps the more radical intellectuals. It's also in the interests, actually, of Beijing to stir up this controversy, even though this is paradoxical. Beijing wants to use this, that means the perceived rise of nativist feelings in Hong Kong, as a pretext for further crackdown on democracy in Hong Kong. So you can say that the hard line adopted by Beijing towards Hong Kong is responsible for the rise of nativist, even pro-independence sentiments within this special administrative region.
Willie Lam says since President Xi Jinping assumed his office 3.5 years ago, there has been what he calls a draconian crackdown on freedom of expression and media in Hong Kong. We're just 80 days away from the Rio 2016 Olympics, but instead of excitement dominating the social media conversation, people are talking about whether to postpone the games or even move them. A Canadian public health professor raised those ideas last week, saying that they are the only way to prevent Brazil's outbreak of the mosquito-borne Zika virus from becoming a global health disaster. Zika is more prevalent in Rio State than in any other part of Brazil, and it can cause microcephaly, that's a birth defect, which babies born to infected mothers have abnormally small heads. The Zika threat to Rio was the focus of this week's hashtag VOA TV show. Host Michael Lippin is with me in the studio. And Michael, who did you speak with today?
Thank you very much, Jim. It's good to be here. Well, that Canadian health professor at the University of Ottawa, Amir Adaran, was part of our panel. We also spoke to Dr. Chris Gaffney, a geography researcher at the University of Zurich, as well as British social commentator Ellis Cashmore of Aston University in Birmingham. Now, during the show, Gaffney asserted that the Olympics have become so important to humanity that people think they should proceed whatever the cost. This is how Cashmore responded to that idea.
The likes of Samsung and Visa and Coca-Cola, McDonald's, in concert with all the global media corporations who are showing the games all over the world. I mean, London was shown to about 3.8 billion people at any one point. They're the people who are driving this. I mean, we can voice as much concern as we like, but ultimately, the games are dictated by the IOC, that is the International Olympic Committee, in concert with global corporations. And I share your concerns and I share your morality, but the point is that it's not shared by the people who are organizing the games.
Oh, I agree with that 100%. And I do think that we need to be able to voice our concerns about the impending reality that these games are bringing. And wherever they go, they tend to bring destruction of some kind or another. And that this business model, which you're explaining very succinctly and very well, this business model is at the heart of the problem. And when we're talking...
Let me try and put some figures on this, Chris, and you others in the studio. We have to calculate from guesstimates because the IOC will not release the exact figures. But sponsorships alone from the likes of, as I mentioned earlier, Visa, McDonald's, etc., comes to $1 billion. And I think we're a bit cavalier when we use the word billion nowadays. Let's remind our viewers, a billion is $1,000 million US dollars. The media contracts are at least four times. So we're talking about north of $4 billion.
Ellis, I want to bring in Amir Adaran here. What do you think about what Ellis is saying about the huge amounts of money that are involved in these games?
Well, I think he's being accurate, but he's also, in a sense, being a bit naive. Sure, there's a lot of money on the line. Absolutely, you're right. But ask yourself the following. If someone is putting that much money on the table, don't they have risk insurance in case the event doesn't happen? I mean, of course they do. And I say this not as a public health person at this point, but actually as a lawyer who's drafted contracts, and in any such contract, there will be a clause for force majeure, meaning events that are very big and disruptive.
Well, I gave Cashmore an opportunity to respond to Adaran's point about insurance after a break in the show.
People often say I'm too cynical, and I rejoice in that. I am a cynic. I think what Amir has missed here is the brand damage or potential brand damage that would be caused by a postponement or even worse, a cancellation. It would be the end of the Olympic Games because all the media corporations and all the other sponsors that have invested so much money in these games would be left wondering what they got for the money. Now, they are insured, of course they are, but it's just the brand damage that would resonate around the world. And I don't think that they would go near another Olympic Games. So effectively, that would be
Amir, Ellis, let's give Amir a chance to weigh in here.
Sure. Well, look, there's brand damage, but you know, you mentioned the companies, Ellis, you know, McDonald's, Coca-Cola, Toyota, and the others.
Yeah.
There's significant brand damage for them being associated with the
Great
Olympics
point.
Of brain damage. These are brain damage kids.
I'm taking that point. I think there really is a cost-benefit equation going on here. They're calculating whether, and I'm sure the IOC in particular is worried to death about what is going on at the moment, and they have to take the risk, I think. They just have to keep their fingers crossed and hope that there is not irreparable damage done during the tournament itself. That would really spell the end of the Olympics.
Well, we had quite a spirited debate in the show, as you can hear from that clip. If you want to hear more, our listeners can go to our website, voanews.com/#VOA, and that's where you can watch the whole show. Jim?
Well, always a great program, and especially after listening to those exchanges, this is a hashtag that you'll definitely want to check out. Michael, thanks so much for stopping by.
Sure.
Just a few minutes, we'll check out one of the athletes hoping to go to Rio. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
This is VOA's International Edition. Olympic athletes are training hard for those summer games in Rio, which begin August 5th. A top American markswoman, five-time Olympic medalist Kim Rhode is aiming to win a sixth medal. Mike O'Sullivan caught up with her during practice at a shooting range in California and filed this report that you may also see on VOAnews.com.
Kim Rhode shoots skeet and trap, aiming at one or two clay targets launched with different trajectories through the air. The sport requires fast reactions and a keen eye. She first competed in the Olympics 20 years ago in Atlanta and has brought home Olympic medals from every games since then, including three golds. She loves being one of the world's top competitors.
And no matter what the event, we all kind of have that common thread or that common story of overcoming or never giving up that really, I think, speaks to the, you know, creed of the Olympics.
Sharpshooter Annie Oakley is one of her inspirations.
I mean, shooting was something that was kind of like the Wild Wild West. It was something that kind of is in the fiber of our country. And so, there's quite a few. Annie Oakley is definitely one. I definitely love the fact that she went out there and gave the boys a run for their money.
Rhode gained national prominence at her first Olympic competition at age 16. Shooting has been a family activity, and Rhode practices with her father, Richard.
My grandfather was a houndsman and grew up in Montana, and he basically brought all those hunting and tradition and outdoor heritages with him, at which time he taught my dad, and my mom and dad taught me.
And she has her eye on the target as she readies for the Rio Games.
It's really been an incredible journey, one that I feel very blessed and honored to have had.
Like other athletes from around the world, she hopes to bring home more Olympic gold from Rio. Her qualifying rounds for the Games wrap up this week. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
You've been listening to International Edition. We are at voanews.com, on Facebook at VOA Now, and on Twitter at VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Zeynep Abdel-Rahman. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Thank you so much for joining us, and have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Colombia is in the final stages of striking a peace agreement with the Rebel Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, known as FARC. That would end a 52-year conflict that has taken the lives of more than 250,000, left 45,000 people missing, and displaced 6.8 million. At a recent meeting with the Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry encouraged both sides to come to a final agreement. He stressed that the United States is very committed to not just helping to achieve the document, but to helping achieve true peace in Colombia. In a promising step, the Colombian government and FARC announced that they had reached an agreement to release child soldiers under 15 years of age from rebel custody and develop a roadmap for an exit for the remaining minors, those between 15 and 18. The deal would eventually involve hundreds of children who were recruited to fight in Colombia's long civil war, though no census of child soldiers has ever been taken. One of the biggest horrors of a conflict is when we drag our children and young people into combat, said Humberto de la Calle, the chief Colombian government negotiator. It's for this reason that this agreement is a crucial advance in the process of bringing this war to a close. The United States, said Secretary Kerry, will continue to lend its support during the post-accord process. Colombia will need help, he said, in areas such as humanitarian demining. And we're working with the president and with his team to define the details of the demining initiative, which we're working on with Norway as co-chairs of that effort, also to help with the post-accord implementation, which will require significant global commitment. President Santos expressed his gratitude to the United States for its crucial support in the peace process. We hope that in the near future we can complete the accord and start building a true peace. The United States remains deeply committed to helping Colombia begin a new chapter in its history, one of reconciliation and peace.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.